Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Once again, we've got it all for you on the show. How do we do it? Week in, week out. First, Iranian-American attorney, writer, and activist Melody Moisey shares her new book, Haldol and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life. It's been called blistering, brash, and irreverent by Atlanta Journal-Constitution, bold and courageous by Kirkus Reviews, and whip-smart but whimsical by the Boston Globe. Bethany Chafin finds out why, and you get to come along for the ride. Arts for Life teaches artistic skills to children in the hospital who are battling life-threatening illnesses. The AFL team is incredible, and we'll meet two of them and find out what makes them tick. Chocolatier Juliana Dulaney is rocking the entire chocolate world, and she's doing it with only two main ingredients. And Greensboro-based guitarist Cheryl Hall is just simply rocking with her band Irada. She sits down with technical producer Eddie Garcia to talk shop, one guitarist to another, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues after this news.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Bethany Chafin. Melody Moisey is an Iranian-American lawyer, activist, and award-winning author. Her latest book is titled Haldol and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life. The memoir chronicles Melody's road to a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. In it, she talks about an early battle with pancreatitis, she addresses psychotic breaks and manic episodes, details the project of writing her first book, War on Error, Real Stories of American Muslims, and comments on the stigma associated with mental illness. Melody brings out the humor and humanity in it all. The book was recently released in paperback, and this month, July, is Minority Mental Health Awareness Month. I spoke with Melody from her home in Raleigh. I'd like it if, for our listeners, you could elaborate on the title, Haldol and Hyacinths, and tell us why these two words particularly pair well for what you're expressing in your book.
Thank you so much for having me on, first off. And secondly, the title of the book, and I'm glad you pronounced it correctly, Haldol is an antipsychotic, and it was the first drug that actually brought me out of psychosis when I was in my worst state. I had an acute manic episode and a psychotic break. Hyacinths are actually one of my favorite flowers, but on top of that, they're highly representative. In Iranian culture, in Persian culture, we have our new year in March, and part of the spread for the new year, we call it a half seen, which translates to seven S's. And one of those scenes, one of those S's is sombol, which means hyacinths. And that represents rebirth for the new year, which again is the first day of spring. So those two things, the idea of rebirth, and also this one drug that finally pulled me out of psychosis. It's not something I take every day at all, but it was the one thing that first worked for me to bring me back to reality. So those two things together have meaning in that sense.
And could you tell us a bit about the span of the book and what time period it covers? And chronologically, it moves around a bit, but that's sort of important for the way you're telling this story. Could you just give us a short synopsis for our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. Mostly it started for me, my first episode of depression was when I was in high school, and that was about my junior year in high school. But mostly this is the book covers the time period where things started getting bad for me. And I was, like most people with bipolar disorder, I was misdiagnosed for an extended period of time. For most people, it takes 8 to 10 years to get a proper diagnosis. It took me 10 years to get a proper diagnosis. I was improperly diagnosed and at some points improperly medicated for unipolar depression. And unfortunately, the medication for that can exacerbate bipolar disorder if you're taking just antidepressants without a mood stabilizer. And that was the case for me at certain points. So at any rate, it covers that time and through college and high school, a little bit of high school, college, and also law school. And after that, I got a master's in public health and started writing when I realized the legal system worked and moved a lot more slowly than I was willing to tolerate. So, and then I became a writer full time. And it covers an acute psychotic break, as I mentioned, before I actually got a proper diagnosis. And that took 3 hospitalizations.
That's one of the things I thought was really captivating about your book was you're very honest about how you were choosing your healthcare providers and about how well-educated and loving your family is and Matthew, your spouse. But even with all of that, you know, what you say about how long it took to have a proper diagnosis made, knowing that, what is your advice then perhaps to someone who is trying to choose a healthcare provider? And even though you said you chose someone who was calm and had wonderful credentials, what do you tell people to look for?
Yeah, well, that's the thing about advice. I would never trust one person for anything. Imagine if you had cancer. Would you trust one diagnosis? I wouldn't. And even though it may cost more money up front, and it will, to get a second, third, fourth opinion, it's worth it. Because if you're misdiagnosed for 10 years, you could get even worse. And in some cases, you can't go back from that. Now I'm at a point, if I caught this illness early on, I could have caught it in what they call bipolar 2, before I had hallucinations and delusions and things like that. But now that's happened. And once your brain has sort of gone to those places, it's easier to go back. So now my official diagnosis is bipolar 1, which is the most extreme form of the illness. So I think it's incredibly important to get a proper diagnosis early on. I'm so glad that you asked about it. Sometimes other people living with the illness will be able to see things that physicians can't. And I write about it in the book with my first hospitalization after my first suicide attempt. A bunch of the other patients told me, you know, we think you're bipolar. We don't think you have depression, because what happened to me and happens sometimes after suicide attempts and people with bipolar disorders, I sort of vaulted into a low-grade mania. And the patients caught it. The doctors didn't, because they didn't see me enough. They weren't watching me enough. And when you're dealing with illnesses that are diagnosed based on talking to the patient and witnessing the patient's behavior, a 15-minute med check isn't going to cut it, you know? So I would say get as many opinions as you possibly can, even if it costs a lot to start off, because you may be saving money and definitely struggle and pain and suffering in the end by doing that upfront.
I mentioned Matthew, and you write about him as your rock, and then you say he's actually your boulder. And you know, one of the things you're talking about, the other patients being able to interact with you daily, obviously he knows you best, perhaps. And one of his ways of processing what you all were experiencing was by taking a lot of notes and being very meticulous, and that was his style. Could you tell me about how that probably now or then played into your writing of this book? Because you revisited some of those notes.
There, you know, depression, mania, and psychosis can do a number on your memory, and they do. Not to say, and I will say, with psychosis in particular, a lot of people say you won't remember anything if you're in psychosis. And that is an argument for allowing the use of restraints in a way that I don't think is appropriate. I think it's a way of arguing for the use of solitary confinement, which I also think is inappropriate in most cases. I would say 99% of cases. So just because you think we'll forget, we may not. There are parts of my experiences in psychosis that I did not forget. But there was a great deal that I did forget, and that without those notes, I couldn't have written this book. I couldn't have known what really happened. I had to interview my family, and I found out a lot of things that were, I just didn't know. I really didn't, which is sort of terrifying. But at the same time, I think I have a better picture of what happened to me that I wouldn't have otherwise. And it helped me on the road to recovery just to have those notes and see what the symptoms were that I exhibited early on. And for me, some of those now I'm learning afterwards that some of those symptoms, I'm sort of lucky. I have hallucinations, for example, very early on when, with mania. That's a lucky thing for me because I can catch it very early. Most people, that doesn't happen. And I know they're hallucinations within the first 24 hours or so. And I have visual hallucinations, which are also really rare with bipolar. It's not quite as common to have visual hallucinations, but I do. So it makes it a little easier to catch it early on. It also makes it a little scarier. But once you get used to it, I think it makes it easier to manage the illness in a way that helps you be functional.
You mentioned an episode of mania, or, you know, you talk about actually about several in your book. And I found it interesting that mania in combination with, or a manic episode in combination with some of your passions and desires to be an activist, they actually sort of were working together for a while. And I found your chapter on hooping for peace really fascinating. I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit about some of the anecdotes that a reader would find in that chapter.
So when I first started exhibiting signs of what turned out to be acute mania, it was in 2008, and sort of the whole country was going through this Obama mania, And I was too, especially I was working towards stopping a potential bombing of Iran, and a potential war with my home country of Iran, where I was, where both my parents are from and I'm from originally, though I was born in the States. But basically the whole idea behind this organization that I founded that I thought was brilliant, I called it Hooping for Peace. And I started hula hooping literally for peace, and I started this organization, and we went to the Democratic National Convention. By we, I mean me and my husband in a car with lots of hula hoops, and invited people to come and hula hoop for peace. And at that point, I was mildly delusional in that I actually thought hula hooping could bring about peace, and it didn't help that I got a lot of media attention for it. And it sort of fed into all of that thinking that I could change things. But at the same time, I've always sort of been mildly delusional. And I think to be an activist and consistently stay one throughout your entire life, you have to be mildly delusional to really believe that one person can change the world, which I really do. I genuinely believe that. And I still believe that. Not necessarily through hula hooping and not necessarily in the way that I believed it in that moment. But to say that these sort of mild delusions haven't helped me in my life would be insincere, because I think that they have. And I write in the book about how delusions of grandeur aren't really delusions of grandeur if you meet them at a certain point. In many cases in my life, I was told that there were things that I couldn't do that were impossible. And especially after I was diagnosed, I was told to lower my expectations for my life, that I couldn't expect the things not only that I wanted to do after that point, but the things that I'd already achieved. One of the hospitals over and over, they wrote in my files, patient has delusions that she's a lawyer and an author. So they weren't even able to sort out my delusions, you know. So part of writing this book for me was pointing out how broken our mental health system is. When we can't acknowledge the fact that very intelligent, bright people who are functional in the world and have something to contribute can also have a mental illness, a serious mental illness. And I know a lot of people who are way smarter than me, way more accomplished than I am, and who also live with serious mental illnesses but would never say it because of the stigma surrounding these diagnoses.
Well, and you mentioned there is a stigma in American society surrounding mental illnesses, but you also talk about the stigma surrounding mental illness in Iranian culture. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah, you know, and I faced, as being a member of a bunch of different so-called minorities, as an Iranian, as a Muslim, I experienced different kinds of stigma that I think, I guess, depending on where you're coming from. And I'm glad you bring this up, because this month, July, is Minority Mental Health Month. I think to a certain extent, no matter where you're from and what your background is, you are going to have trouble if you're living with a mental illness. But it's sort of like suddenly you are given this double stigma. And in some cases more than that, depending on how many so-called minorities or historically marginalized communities to which you belong. And there's a sort of distrust that exists in a lot of minority communities, with respect to the health profession and medicine. And both my parents are doctors, so you would think that distrust would not exist. But it did, and it did exist in my community to a certain extent, that it was possible that it could be just some sort of moral failing, that this wasn't actually an illness. Thankfully, in my case, my family, both my parents, caught on quickly. My husband caught on quickly. My sister is also a physician, caught on quickly. But there was a fear and said, this is a real illness. You need to take your medication, that kind of thing. So no one ever tried to send me to get an exorcism or anything like that, which I know people that things like that have happened to. But yeah, so my experience has just been that the stigma within the Iranian community is just as bad, and in some ways worse. We don't have a real name for some of these illnesses. We've just borrowed from other languages, and there's a kind of gossipy, in the diaspora in particular, it can be very gossipy, right? And this is with the Iranian community, the Pakistani community, a lot of immigrant communities, because we're smaller, right? So the fear was that other people would find out, and when they would, suddenly they wouldn't be, not only would they not be supportive, but they would start talking behind my back and judging me for it. But what I've found since I published the book, actually, is that I wish they had known. Because they would have been very supportive, now I'm realizing. And maybe part of it has to do with my having published this book and everything like that, and them being able to read so much about what my experience was. But I don't think that's it. I think part of it is also me projecting a level of stigma onto my community that didn't really exist, that wasn't as strong, at the very least, that wasn't as strong as I initially suspected.
One of the ways that you break the silence is with humor, at least, I think. And I found that really engaging. And I wonder if, you know, humor was something that helped you throughout, or humor has just always been kind of a way that you process and interact with the world.
Yeah, for me, it's my top survival mechanism. I would not be here without a sense of humor. And some of the things I wrote about in the book, and honestly, I mean, strip searches and things that were really dehumanizing, but at the same time, just hilarious in the moment, just thinking about it. When I write about, for example, in one of the hospitals, I was submitted to strip searches every day, or every twice or three times a week, I think it was. Every time I saw my family afterwards, I had to do these strip searches. And early on, I realized that the people who were conducting it, there were about three nurses who were conducting it. And early on, I realized they were a lot more nervous than I was. And I used that to my advantage in a really manipulative way, and ended up just making them even more uncomfortable in the way that I was doing my strip search. For example, they would say, you don't actually need to take off your underwear, but I would do it and throw it at them. That was how vicious and horrible I was. But at the moment, like I should say, I was psychotic at some points. But you can't completely overlook the humor there. And if you do, I think it'll kill you if you don't try and inject it into everything. At least for me, it was just something that the way that my brain works and the way that I cope with things.
So for someone who has recently been diagnosed as having bipolar disorder, what kind of advice or resources would you offer them?
I would really recommend that they look into their local DBSA or NAMI meetings, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance. These are amazing organizations. You don't have to pay anything, and you can go to support groups. I went religiously after I was first diagnosed to DBSA support groups in Atlanta, and I fully believe they helped save my life. Being able to learn from other people living with mental illness, there's no amount of money that can pay for that. It's just such an education, whether the people in your group are succeeding or failing in how they're dealing and coping with their illnesses. You just can learn so much. And it was just the best thing for me, was to be able to go to those support groups. And I'm not the support group type of person. It took me a while to actually get interested, and my husband forced me to go to the first one. The first couple. So I would say that. I would also really like to share the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K, and to say that 20% of people with bipolar, up to 20% of us, end up taking our own lives. That's a serious issue. And if we're going to talk about, for example, gun control, which is the only time we seem to talk about mental illness, is when there's some sort of mass shooting or something like that. But if we're going to talk about gun control and violence, people with mental illness are no more violent than the general population. When you control for substance abuse, we're actually much more likely to be victims of violent crime than the general population. And when you talk about gun control, 2/3 of all gun fatalities are suicides, and more than half of all suicides are gun-related, and there are twice as many suicides as there are homicides in this country. So if we want to be talking about those issues, we need to be talking about suicide, not homicide. We're not running out and killing people. We're not inherently violent. That's not an issue that you need to be worried about. What you need to be worried about is your own family members and the risk of suicide, because it is very high with these illnesses.
I don't want to see you disappear.
Activist, attorney, and author Melody Moisey. This Friday, Melody will discuss and read from her latest book, Haldol and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life, at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro. The event is sponsored by the Mental Health Association in Greensboro, and it begins at 7 p.m. and goes until 8:30 p.m. Scuppernong is located at 304 South Elm Street in Greensboro. Melody's talk will be titled From Restraints to Recognition, Thriving with Mental Illness. The event is free and open to the public. For more information and a link to Melody's website, where you can read excerpts of her book and view her YouTube series, A Saner Spin on Crazy, visit our website at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a short break before returning with The Art of Chocolate, Rock Guitar, and Arts for Life next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Arts for Life supports pediatric patients and families through arts education in four chapters across North Carolina. The nonprofit began here in the Triad back in 2001 at Brenner Children's Hospital in Winston-Salem. Executive Director Rachel Zink and Program Director Betsy McClawhorn spoke with me about the program.
I want to be a teacher of art, 'cause to me, that is the best part. Showing kids how to draw.
You know, what's unique about Arts for Life is we bring the arts into pediatric hospital settings. And so we're teaching art skills, music, and creative writing to young patients and their families where they're living, where they're existing while they're facing medical crisis, fighting illness or disability. And so there are lots of great art programs in hospitals these days. I think one out of every two children's hospital has an art program of some kind. Typically, people think of it as therapy, art therapy or music therapy. But what makes Arts for Life unique is that we are education-based. And so we have a fantastic curriculum. We have monthly themes. It's very education-oriented. And so our kids are learning skills, art skills, as well as life skills. And they're engaged in the process from start to finish. So we're very much about the process and not the product. Our kids are learning and having a great time and exploring their own creativity and imagination.
This is something you see every day, Betsy, this the kind of inspiring courage through creativity, which is a great way of expressing that. I'm curious to know what you've learned over the decade of working with young people there.
Well, definitely my greatest teachers are the students I work with, for sure. I have learned so much from them over the years, from them teaching me how to do origami to also learning about myself as a teacher and how different styles work for different children. And I think all the program directors across the state would agree with that. So what Rachel was mentioning about our themes, for example, July is food and farm and mixed media. So each of the program directors sat down and did our research, and we all wrote 3 to 4 lessons and shared those with each other so that we come to the table with 12 lessons at least each month. And with those lessons, we choose 3 to do each week. And the kids have choices. And that's the most important thing to give the kids in the hospitals, is they don't have a lot of choices. They can't say, you know what, I don't want to do chemo today. But they can say, I don't feel like painting. Let's do some sculpture.
I am a thunderstorm causing havoc wherever I go, wherever I go.
I have kids that will come into the hospital, and a lot of them, what gets them through those doors is the art table. And I've had so many parents tell me over the years and tell our volunteers that thank goodness we could use you guys as an excuse to get here, because they did not want to come this morning. It was hard getting them out the door. But as soon as I said, well, Arts for Life table is open, you can do art when you get there. As soon as you get your fingers stuck and we see the doctor, let's go out to the table. And they'll hop right in the van because they know they get to do art. And one thing that I love is when the parents choose to stay after the appointment, they could go home. They've been at the clinic all morning and they could say, let's head home. But no, they come to the art table and they will stay with their child at the art table for an hour, 3 hours, however long their child wants to stay. And we're there 8 hours a day at least. Most days we're even there 12 hours a day. So the art table is always open in the morning, and a lot of times reopens in the afternoon for those kids that say, I want to come back.
And for our kids who are school age, you know, we don't really know what kind of art interaction they're getting at school. It may be, you know, 20 minutes once a week. It may be more time than that or more meaningful. But a lot of times kids and parents will tell us that this is the first one-on-one art experience they've had with an art teacher, where somebody has come to them and said, what would you like to create today? And taught them art skills. So it's really like having, you know, your own personal art teacher, and coach and mentor kind of all in one at the art table. And that goes for music and creative writing. So a lot of these kids are getting their very first real quality art experience at the hospital, which is pretty incredible.
Why don't you describe the art table? We've heard a reference several times here. What goes on at the art table? What's it like?
So the art table was moved into a large waiting room, and we have floor-to-ceiling windows that overlook all of Ardmore, which is just a beautiful view.
This is at Brenner's?
At Brenner Children's Hospital. We're up on the ninth floor, so we have a wonderful view, natural light, and the kids just feel at ease when they come in because it is a really welcoming environment, and it's all about the art. We have the table set up with your basics. You've got colored pencils, markers, crayons, watercolor paints, and then anything they want, our room is filled with cabinets. So if they say, you know what, I don't feel like doing that painting today, I really want to do a sculpture with Model Magic, and let's bring out some acrylic paint. I just walk over, unlock a cabinet, and get what they want. So pretty much we don't say no at the art table, which is really exciting because I feel like in an art room, the teachers don't have the choice to be able to say, you know, hey, we're going to do lots of projects today. They can say we're doing this one project for a series of weeks, where I can have a kid come to the table and they can do three totally different projects in the span of an hour to 3 hours, whatever they want.
Rachel, is there an overarching philosophy for Arts for Life in terms of the teaching?
There is, and this is a philosophy that was created by Arts for Life staff, and it's really drawing upon all these wonderful years of service to these young patients and families. And, you know, it starts off with the overarching theme, which is that art is for everyone, and we believe that. Everyone is welcome at the art table. Young patients, their brothers and sisters, who can often feel like they take a back seat when their sibling is diagnosed with an illness. Parents, grandparents, everybody's welcome at the art table. Some mm-hmm. of the most magical moments happen when the whole family is sitting down together creating art and having that family experience with us. We believe in using the arts as a foundation for self-expression, discovery, and a lifelong love of learning.
Mm. What you all provide, both, I mean, institutionally, but then individually, that one-on-one, is such a great gift, but a big responsibility, too, I imagine. How do you navigate that, Betsy?
We have really extensive training for all of our volunteers and interns, and it's something that has been developed over the years since the beginning of Arts for Life. And we're very cautious of boundaries and just making sure that at all times, the patient is in the best interest and just their safety and their happiness also, because we want the art table to be a happy place. We want them to have a positive experience every time we do art with them. And so that's just always on the forefront of our mind. I feel like this speaks so much to what it does for the families. I asked a mom for a 2-to-3-sentence quote, and she wrote a page and a half about what Arts for Life did for them, for their daughter and her sibling. But one of the things that she said was that you would never know as a parent what happens room to room, because Arts for Life staff carries their pain, sorrow, and joy so discreetly that when you walk into the next room, that parent, that child has no idea what you just encountered. And that's really important. And it's something that I always tell in my trainings to the new volunteers and interns, if there's one thing you take away from this, it's that sentence right there. And just know that when you go room to room, each family is their own. And, you know, just it's important to maintain that.
Easy said, hard to do. I remember talking to Colin Allured, one on the staff there, a really talented singer-songwriter, guitarist. And he spoke to his need to look at the positive on how he's impacting families and the kids and drawing strength from that. Because you lose children along the way. How do you process that? How do you deal with just the nature of these illnesses? And they're just horrific.
It's never easy. It's one of those things that over the years, people have said, oh, it must get easier. It doesn't. It just becomes a matter of learning how to cope and really paying attention to caring for the caregiver. It's something that I stress with my volunteers and interns and really try to do for myself as well. Because if we don't take care of ourselves, we can't be there for the kids on the level they need us to be. So one of the things that I'll do is I'll have gatherings for my volunteers and interns. It might be a workshop where we focus on patients that we've lost and just take the time to remember them. And we share memories of the kids, and we sit down and just go around the table, and whoever wants to speak speaks. And there's lots of laughter and lots of tears in those meetings. And we always walk away more connected and stronger as a group. And that makes us stronger as individual teachers. And just reminding them on a weekly basis that, you know, these are the things you can do to take care of yourself.
A comment you get a lot when you tell people what we do for a living is, gosh, that must be so sad, or that must be so hard. And it is. There are some very low lows, but the highs are so high. You walk in and see that art table in the waiting room of a pediatric cancer clinic, and it's full of kids crowded around the art table, and there's always room for one more. If another kid comes up and it feels like all the seats are full, well, those kids are moving their IV poles and making room for one more always. It's full of color and creativity and excitement and joy and laughter. And that's almost inconceivable when you think about where these kids are, but they would never know it. They're artists, they're poets, they're writers, they're musicians, they're composers. They're doing all of these amazing creative things in the face of some really difficult struggles. And that is so inspiring to me, and I think inspiring to all of our supporters, all the people that support Arts for Life along the way, our hospital partners, our donors, our volunteers and interns, who are just some of the most caring, compassionate people I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. And at the end of the day, we're not changing a diagnosis, but we believe Arts for Life can really help transform this experience for kids and their families, and that's really important.
One day after another, they all ran together, and all of them gray.
And we get a chance to tap into the inspirational nature of these patients and their work at the opening reception for Outside the Box. First, let's get into the art itself. I mean, you all offer everything. I mean, from painting and sculpture to 3D, two-dimensional work. What's going to be on display? And talk about Outside the Box.
I'm really excited about this exhibit. It's going to be our largest exhibit we've ever had. And it was a way to bring in the volunteers a little bit more. For years, a lot of the artwork that was on display was something that maybe one or two volunteers or myself worked on with the kids. But this one, I involved the entire group, and we have done workshops. And the best place to start, I think, is the Ruby Heart Adventure. And it is a movie that's going to be playing on a loop in the auditorium at SECA. And our kids made all the costumes out of cardboard, and they have masks, and we've got a tiny little bat with these just hilarious little wings on his elbows. But the whole idea for the movie came from one piece of art that one of the patients created years ago. I think it was in 2005 he created this piece. And it has been hanging in clinic, and it's one of everyone's favorites. And it's a picture of a dragon on a rocket ship flying through space. And we brought that out, and we use that as our inspiration for the story. And I have the group with the Kids Connect group, which is our support group for young kindergarten through eighth grade. And it's our patients and siblings. And they sat down, they looked at it, and within minutes, they had a full storyline. And they were picking out who was going to be who in the movie. And so they wrote it out and then sat down with the computer and just told the story. And we recorded that. And one of our interns, Jenna Lacey, her special project for her internship was to create this movie, to put all the pieces together, do all of the editing, all of the filming. And it took months. We thought it would take three sessions. Our sessions are about 2 hours, and it ended up taking six. But it was worth every minute of it. And I think the kids enjoyed the process as much as they're going to enjoy seeing the final product. It's definitely a group that loves the process. And in the movie, the kids are wearing their masks that they created. Some of them fit over their head. Some are just on the face with Velcro. One of the little girls, at the end of every session, she would just look at the piece of art, because we always had the art on display. And she would say, "I cannot believe that all of this is coming from that one piece of art." And she would get so excited about it. And I mean, she would come in and say, "Where's that piece of art? I can't believe that this is happening. What are we going to think up today?" And the final filming was absolutely hilarious, because we had kids running around in all these crazy masks, and we were out in the main lobby. And so anyone that was coming into clinic was seeing this happen. They had no idea what was going on. And one little girl was like, "I want to be in that movie." And we just happened to need an extra tiny bear, and we had an extra mask. And so while she didn't get to be a part of making the mask, she was part of the movie. And so she's our little bear. And all those masks will be on display at SECA. And in addition to that, so the theme is cardboard, something that we don't get to use a lot of at the hospital. And the kids love working big. So it gave them a chance to really just think big and think outside the box. Like, I would give them an entire box. I would go and buy a piece of clean cardboard, because we can't bring any dirty cardboard into the hospital. And I'd buy a piece of clean cardboard, and I would give them the entire box and say, "What can you do with this?" And we'd lay it flat, And from a platypus to an 8-foot bird to a 3-foot peacock, we've got it all.
Wow.
And so that's part of the totem project. So floor to ceiling, or as high as we can get up there on the ladder, we're going to have totems on one of the walls. And the fun part with the totems is that we're going to also encourage the community to be a part of that show. And so we're going to have a table set up where kids, parents, anyone that attends the opening night can make a tiny mask or tiny totem and add it to the wall. We have 2-inch tiny masks that we have done on the 7th floor. We recently expanded our programming to the 7th floor, which is a general clinic. And we see so many kids, and they're there for 5 minutes to 30 minutes. So not enough time to sit down and create an 8-foot squid. Down there, they're making these tiny masks of whatever they want, whatever their spirit animal is, or whatever their favorite animal is. And that's where the community will get to come in. And once they finish, they can place it on the wall. And that'll be just a fun addition to have the community be a part of this final art show.
Volunteers and interns play a really big role in planning these sorts of special exhibits. How big is the volunteer component for AFL?
At all times, we have about 20. Summer, we have fewer people because we have interns that do anywhere from 10 to 20 hours a week. This summer, we have 4 interns, and one of them is a community intern. And in addition to that, we have a few new volunteers. So, for example, Bryce Hauser, who's one of our brand new volunteers, he does installations, and so he's going to be installing the show for us, which is wonderful help. So we have our volunteers are able to help us both in the hospital and outside of the hospital, but it definitely will have a huge team there installing that day.
Our volunteer team is really, truly amazing. It's a great big team of over 20 people that's led by Betsy and supported by Betsy. We have a really fantastic training program that makes sure all of our volunteers and interns feel really confident for when they walk into that hospital room for the first time or sit down at the art table and kids come up. But, you know, we're always on the lookout, too, for great volunteers. And our number one requirement is that they must love kids. And it really helps to have an artistic or creative background, but you don't have to be a professional artist to be a volunteer at Arts for Life. We have had everywhere from, you know, college interns who are studying art and they're just getting started to mid-career professional artists, everything in between, writers, musicians, all kinds of creative types that come and join our team. And, you know, we ask for a minimum of 9-month commitment, but a lot of our volunteers stick around a lot longer because they just love the experience so much, and the kids give them more than they give the kids. Like Betsy said, the kids are our greatest teachers.
Arts for Life Executive Director Rachel Zink and Program Director Betsy McClawhorn. Arts for Life patients in all 3 of their hospital-based programs, clinic waiting room art tables, bedside art lessons, and art support groups have been busy at work for months creating original artwork and an original film for their new show, Outside the Box. The exhibit will feature creatively recycled cardboard-inspired artwork, masks, sculptures, and costumes from kids in Arts for Life's programs at Brenner Children's Hospital. The opening reception for Outside the Box was Thursday, July 17th at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, 750 Marguerite Drive in Winston-Salem, where it will remain on display, and it's free. It's an all-ages exhibit with an interactive hands-on art activity for attendees and a screening of the student film The Ruby Heart Adventure with cardboard costumes designed and created by Arts for Life patients. You'll find a link to more information at WFGD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's time for another short break, but fear not, because we're back in just 60 seconds with rock and roll and chocolate, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Bethany Chafin. Moravian spice cookie truffle with fresh ginger, creme brulee with caramel and hazelnut, saffron curry. These are just a few of the over 150 flavor combinations created by chocolate alchemist Giuliana Dulaney. Dulaney is the owner of Winston-Salem-based Haute Chocolate, now housed at Twin City Hive on Brookstown Avenue. A self-taught chocolatier and baker, Giuliana and her creations have been featured in publications such as Southern Living and on the CNN food blog Eatocracy. Giuliana stopped by to tell me about the art of chocolate making.
I actually didn't even really start baking until I opened our first shop. That was probably the first time I ever baked more than like a box mix cake. But the chocolate making I hadn't done before I moved here. I always wanted to learn how to make them, but I just never took the initiative because every time I looked into going to pastry chef school, it was just way too expensive for me.
That means you're self-taught.
Yes, I'm definitely self-taught.
What does that look like? Does that look like a lot of experimentation? Does that look like some books or YouTube videos or a little bit of everything?
Honestly, I saw a demonstration on how to make chocolate truffles one time, and I thought that I could simplify the process by eliminating all the extra ingredients. And so I went home and started experimenting in the kitchen and eliminated everything except the two main components of chocolate. Just a lot of experimentation in the kitchen and doing a lot of research and development on my own. I never have watched a YouTube video. I've never read any real books about chocolate making. I have one, but I just wanted to teach myself how to do it and just learn by doing and making my own mistakes, because I kind of felt like if I'm going to commit to this as a business or anything else, I wanted to make sure that any kind of mistake that I ever came across, I knew how to fix it.
When you said you boil it down to two main components, I'm guessing that's cocoa and sugar?
Well, it's the chocolate itself and then heavy cream. That's it.
It's really interesting to me that kind of some of your early philosophy was about simplifying, because when I went into Haute Chocolate, which is your first store, you had literally a periodic table of your chocolates and their flavors and all of the really creative combinations that you were coming up with. Because you simplify, it seems like maybe you were able to go in some fun directions.
Exactly.
With the types of chocolates you were making. Tell me about some of those combinations.
What I wanted to accomplish by simplifying the chocolate making process was being able to infuse different spices and different fruits and stuff from different parts of different countries. And the only way I was going to be able to make those flavors pop was to get rid of the fillers. So one of my personal favorite chocolates to make, which I haven't made in a really long time, is our Spring in Saigon, inspired by a drink at Tate's Craft Cocktails. And it has fresh cranberries, fresh lavender, lime zest, and honey in a white chocolate. And I cover it in dark chocolate. And I put the Chinese character for spring on top, like I painted on there. So probably my favorite chocolate to produce is our creme brulee, which is actually our most popular one. I get to make a homemade caramel, which is probably one of the things that I'm best known for in my shop. So I make a homemade caramel and I use hazelnuts and infuse it all together with white chocolate. And then when I dip it in the white chocolate, I cover it with a little bit of sugar and caramelized top. So you get that sugar snap when you bite into it. And then it's like almost a custard in the middle. It's just incredible.
Well, you even called it chocolate alchemist. But what does that term mean to you? Like, why is that kind of a good description of what you do?
So the alchemy part has a funny story of how that got started. When I first started the business, it was called Sweet Dreams Confectionery, and I had a business partner. And we very much complimented each other in the fact that we would just throw stuff in a pot, see if it worked. And I kind of felt like that was what needed to happen. So I definitely call myself an alchemist because I don't weigh anything. I don't measure any of the ingredients. It's all done by sight. It's all done by taste. No two batches are going to ever taste exactly the same. But that's okay because I make such small quantities of the chocolates that I don't want them to all taste exactly the same.
Tell me about the coffees that you all provide. And, you know, if someone walks in, what else they can find, like from local providers?
So the coffees that we do are all roasted here in North Carolina. We have 6 different coffee roasters right now. They range in roasts from different countries from all over the world. So we have Ethiopian coffee, Panamanian coffee, Costa Rican coffee, just all of them are so different. Each roaster is completely and totally different. And we can have coffees that are grown in the same exact country and they will be completely different flavor profiles. And I think that's one of the most incredible things that we have going for us is that we're not a single roaster coffee shop. We embraced the multi-roaster business model and decided to not do espresso and just serve only pour over and drip coffees. And then we have cold brew coffee, which is takes 24 hours to make one batch because it's brewed in cold water. In addition to that, we have tea that's made locally here in Winston-Salem by Chad's Chai. All of the items that we have in shop are all made locally. Just everything we wanted to provide for our guests to purchase or to enjoy on site or at their homes, we wanted to make sure that everything was done in state. We wanted to embrace all of that and then make it an art gallery as well. So the artists that we have are all local within probably a 50-mile radius, if not less. And all of their work has been picked out by the artists, so they are displaying exactly what they want. It's really incredible, like, how it's all come together.
Juliana Dulaney is the chocolatier behind Haute Chocolate in Winston-Salem. Her creations can be found at Twin City Hive on Brookstown Avenue, where visitors can also enjoy curated coffees from around North Carolina. This Sunday, July 20th, is the Twin City Hive Artist Market. The market begins at 12 p.m. at 301 Brookstown Avenue and will feature local artisans, including Twin City Hive's two Artists of the Month, Jennifer O'Kelly and Dale Edwards. Their works are currently on display in the shop. For more information and to see some pictures behind the scenes at Haute Chocolate, visit our website at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. The Greensboro-based band Irata started in 2007. At that time, they were an instrumental act, fusing ambient textures with progressive metal-leaning rhythms. After some lineup changes and self-imposed vocal training, they added full-time guitar to the mix and brought the heavier aspects of their music to the forefront. Irata have a new split 10-inch vinyl EP dropping this weekend via Crimson Records. You can grab a copy and experience Irata live at two release shows, Friday, July 18th at Ziggy's and Saturday, July 19th at Chapel Hill Underground. Irata guitarist Cheryl Hall stopped by WFDD and told me about the writing of the epic song Semyase.
It was looking like it was kind of going to go the normal way where John and Jason kind of write everything and I come in afterwards. But what had happened with that is John was actually playing the verse riff for it on his bass, and I had my guitar on and I was on a clean channel and I just started like playing it along with him and just adding some notes. And he was like, oh wow, that's really awesome. That's cool. Do that. So, okay. So we did that. And then the next time we came into rehearsal, he had another riff that was just so catchy. It was unbelievable. So we were like, okay, how can we put those two riffs together? And we worked that in. And then the next time we came to rehearsal, he had another riff that was just so catchy. And so, you know, we managed to take all these riffs and kind of link them together and then find out, okay, well, how can we keep it interesting? How can we build this, you know, from the soft, quiet beginning to like a really heavy middle, and then, you know, kind of trails off at the end.
So John is your bass player.
Yes.
So the bass player coming in with the riffs and building off of that is a little different.
I haven't been in too many other bands, but as a guitar player, you know, you kind of go into writing songs with a mindset of like, I'm going to play the riff, mm-hmm. and then the bass player is just going to like follow me. And so when you start out with a bass riff, my first inclination is to, okay, well, I'm going to play something different. So I'm not always mirroring what he does. But you know, sometimes it doesn't serve the song, and that's what we talk about a lot when we're writing is, you know, it may be cool, but if it's not like an Irata song, let's not do it, you know? So he'll come in with a riff, I'll play a handful of things on top of it. Sometimes I may get it right away, sometimes it may take a while, but we just spend a lot of time like communicating about what we're hearing and what we're feeling for how the song should be.
Okay. Tell me about your approach to guitar and how long you've been playing.
So I've been playing for 15 years.
Okay.
And I am totally from like Metallica, Iron Maiden school. Like that's the music I learned. That's how I learned how to play guitar. It was just, you know, playing their songs. And I'm a classical musician as well. So, you know, I'm all about the scales and tones.
Were you classically trained on guitar or piano or...
Well, I started off with piano and flute when I was younger, but yeah, then I studied classical guitar for several years as well. So I've got all that behind me, and that's how I approach guitar, which I think you don't hear a lot on the albums because it's just not the sound that Irada is going for. And that's always really funny to be in our writing spaces. You know, I'll play something very classical or very melodic, and they're like, let's not do that.
Cheryl Hall. She's the guitarist for Irada. You can catch Cheryl with her Gibson SG and Mesa Boogie amp in tow when Irada plays Ziggy's on Friday, July 18th, and Chapel Hill Underground, Saturday, July 19th. Irada has a new split EP with the band Solar Halos, and it's available on vinyl and CD. For more music and videos from Irada, visit WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our executive producer is David Ford, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. Our intern is Michaela Nance. You'll find archived episodes and podcasts on our website at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well at Triad Arts Speak. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Email your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.